Hi, I'm Larry Schultes, and this is Managed Services, The Basics. I have been practicing law since 1992, and in that time have been focusing on outsourcing, software licensing, and services agreements, and before that was in technology. So, as I go through this CLE, I am assuming that you have the slide deck. I will not necessarily mention each item that's on the slides, so please do refer to the slide deck as we go. Also, I think the first place to start in discussing managed services is to make sure we're clear on what that term means. I think there's a broad continuum between pure software as a service, like Office 365 at one end, and at the opposite end, large-scale outsourcing that we saw in the 1990s and the first decade of this century. In the middle is managed services. Managed services could include software, like software as a service would do, but would typically add the element of perhaps providing personnel who use that software. Alternatively, managed services might not involve providing software at all and could just focus on a service element. As an example, I'm going to refer to a managed service that I've worked on a number of times for a client of mine. That client will work with companies that have licensed software from a third party that is used to operate the back office of an insurance company. My client implements that software for the insurance company, and then we'll offer, as a managed service, to host the software, make changes to it over time, or make changes to the implementation, more accurately, over time, implement updates to the software from the vendor, and perform reporting and other IT functions for the insurance company. So the managed service consists of the hosting and support of the implementation that internal IT personnel might otherwise provide. So, moving to the first slide, what's the lawyer's role in a managed service contract? I think that the lawyer's role actually can be quite extensive in these kinds of arrangements, particularly when you're working on the client side. In the transactions that are run the best, the participation begins at the RFP stage. In order to have a successful managed service contract, the first important step is to get the right proposals from vendors. And in order to get the right proposals from vendors, you need to send out a good RFP. The request for proposals. The request for the RFP to be successful must reflect a good understanding of the needs of the client that the managed service is meaning to meet. That involves gathering information through interviews with end users, with stakeholders, and others. It may be advisable for a client to get a sourcing partner involved as well that is used to gathering this sort of information and preparing an RFP. But I think part of the lawyer's role is to make sure that the RFP process doesn't become a purely mathematical exercise that is based upon a spreadsheet and ticking off answers, but it remains a thoughtful process of evaluating the responses and not trying to break everything down into commodities as if you were buying lumps of coal. The lawyers also, I think, a key in advising on the risk balance between between the vendor and what risks are appropriate to try to push on to the vendor and which ones need to be retained by the client. In leading the negotiations process and drafting the agreement, and if things don't go necessarily as they should in renegotiating or terminating the agreement. Managed services are long-term relationships, and so I have always found that one of the most important goals of this process should be a mutually beneficial deal. You don't want to end up in a situation where the managed services vendor has been pushed so hard that they're losing money. A vendor who is there in a multi-year deal losing money month over month is not going to be a business partner that is going to be serving the needs of your client well. So, what's the structure of a managed services agreement? What I've typically found is that you've got a contractual set of T's and C's up front, as you would expect, an agreement, a glossary. My very strong guidance on this one is that there should be a separate glossary that is after the terms of the agreement and not start your contract with Section 1 definitions. Pulling the definitions to the back and putting them all in one place rather than having them sprinkled through the agreement and then the schedules makes the entire agreement much easier to manage, but also putting the definitions after the terms and conditions means that negotiations don't start on day one with diving into the definitions. That is, both from a vendor or a customer's perspective, the worst place to start, because the definitions tend to be very fine, specific items. That's kind of the essence of a definition. And getting down into those details first sets a bad tone. I think it's more important to get the business terms, pass through the business terms. What are the services? What are the payment terms? What are some of the key legal terms, even limits of liability, before we dive down into the details of the definitions? So there also tends to be a number of schedules, exhibits, or addenda to a managed services agreement. Scope as one, service levels as another, charges. Depending upon the size of the agreement, there may be a governance schedule, because this is a long-term relationship. You are going to need to be meeting frequently and having communication at multiple levels, so that the vendor and the customer stay aligned. So what are key contractual terms in a managed services agreement? Well, we've got a list here, and we will have slides for each one of these, so I'd rather not read you the list. Let's dive into the first one, staffing and employment. So, how important this is depends upon the nature of the managed service. If we go back to my early example of the managed service that is hosting and maintaining a mission-critical application, there are going to be a number of personnel that are key to the relationship. There will probably be dedicated staff, people who are always working with this client, but there is also typically shared staffing. Shared staffing is common in managed services because part of how a managed service may be more cost-effective for the client is that a pool of personnel will be performing whatever function for multiple clients and optimizing the use of their time rather than having this team, admittedly a smaller team at the client, but a team that may not be fully employed or always busy working at the client. So in what's the implication then of dedicated staff versus shared staff? Well, dedicated staff, you know, other than the obvious that they are working solely for this one client, also could be designated in the agreement as key personnel. Key personnel are personnel that are not changed out without the client's consent, or at least are not changed out without the client's consent for a given period of time, like 2 years. Dedicated staff, the turnover of dedicated staff should be minimized because they are the institutional knowledge of how the service is performed. Shared staffing, on the other hand, is typically not under the client's control because it's a labor pool. There may also be a number of experience tiers or labor tiers in the managed service staffing model. If so, one of the key questions is, how does one differentiate between those tiers? I have found that it's very important to have a description, a meaningful description, of the amount of experience and the key certifications or qualifications that are needed to be promoted from one experience tier to another. You may also want to consider restrictions on staff, and in this case, I think it's mainly dedicated staff, performing services for your competitors for a certain period of time after they work with you. This may be a concern. It may not be a concern. To go back to our example of of the back office function of supporting the insurance product that runs the insurance's the insurance company's back office, the insurance company may very much want staff who have worked on their engagement not to work for other insurance companies for a certain period of time because of concerns of maybe trade secrets being communicated to other insurance companies. On the vendor side, of course, the concern is this offering is given only to insurance companies, so that sort of restriction on performing services for competitors could effectively mean that person couldn't work in the business anymore, and that's obviously not going to be acceptable to the vendor. So in that situation, there may be a middle ground of identifying key competitors. So Joe, who's been the project manager here, can't go work for the following three companies, which are our key competitors, but they could work for any other insurance company. So you need to make sure that as you approach this, you are approaching it from a rational basis on both sides. Non-solicitation clauses, the vendor in particular will want a clause that says that the customer can't recruit personnel away. That would allow the customer perhaps to insource the services. Customer may want to prevent the vendor from hiring away personnel to work in the vendor's business. So we definitely need to consider your thoughts on these non-solicitation clauses, or whether perhaps you want to fight against those clauses because you want to be able to do that sort of hiring. Finally, if there are any personnel involved whose functions will be, any personnel involved who are working in Europe and whose job functions will be transferring to the vendor, then you need to be concerned with the Acquired Rights Directive in Europe. I don't want to get into the details of that. Suffice it to say that if those two criteria are met, you need to talk to a lawyer in the applicable EU country to make sure that you are well advised. So, moving on to the slide entitled Staffing and Employment Contract Terms, one thing you definitely want to consider from a customer's perspective is an ability to demand that personnel be replaced if you're not happy with them. That is unlikely to be accepted with when you're working with a labor pool, but it can work with dedicated staff, and it and in particular if there are on-site resources or particular personnel with which you interact on a regular basis, you're going to want the ability to say, we don't want to talk to that person anymore, we don't want them coming on site. And the only really limitation on your ability to refuse those personnel should be that the reason is a lawful reason. Depending upon the nature of the service, you should consider whether you want any training requirements or certifications for the people who are going to be performing the functions. In the example of my insurance managed service, for example, you would, if from a client's perspective, you would want the people who are going to be supporting the software to have received the applicable training requirements and training certifications on that software. So, intellectual property rights. So, one of the key concerns for intellectual property is your ownership of your data. I missed the slide. Key contractual terms, confidentiality and privacy. I am on slide 9. So, obviously, mutual confidentiality terms are very important in most managed services agreements. The vendor is going to want confidentiality to protect their secret sauce, as they often refer to it, their key managed service functions, documentation that they've provided, procedures, etc. On the other hand, the managed service is likely to give the vendor access to confidential information on the client side, and the confidentiality terms and privacy terms need to be aligned to the nature of the data that is likely to be involved. I would avoid in this situation a cookbook solution of putting every possible term in the contract if they're not relevant. If there is no chance that there's going to be European data involved, there's no reason to address GDPR. On the other hand, obviously you do want to include that if it's involved. So I think an important part of the requirements gathering process before the RFP and in the client interviews and expectation setting when drafting the agreement is a understanding of what sort of data will be involved, both personal data and other data, where that data is coming from, so that the confidentiality and privacy terms are aligned to what is actually going to be involved. In interacting with the vendor, from a client's perspective, you're also going to want to know typically where the data will be stored. Is it going to be stored at the vendor's facility or third-party hosting provider? If so, whom? Is it going to be stored in the United States or elsewhere? I'm not saying that the data being outside the United States is necessarily a problem, but you do want to know these things and then be able to evaluate based upon the type of the data involved, what the storage requirements should be and what would be acceptable. A key term in the agreement,
Esquire CLE's first verification code is ZOMBIE, ZOMBIE. ZOMBIE, please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is ZOMBIE, ZOMBIE. Please take a moment and write this down.
From a client perspective, where there is significant data involved is the ability to audit the vendor's security. That can really should start in the RFP process with what most clients use. It's called the Standard Information Gather, or SIG. The Standard Information Gather tool, which is available on the internet, is a very good industry standard tool for asking the vendor a large number of questions about how they handle and protect data and system security. What I will typically do when I'm on the customer side is have the SIG response be part of the contract, and that there be a warranty that the vendor will, or warranty or a covenant that the vendor will maintain compliance with their SIG responses throughout the term. Even where your client doesn't have a lot of leverage, the SIG is useful because most reputable vendors have a standard SIG response. So, will there be third-party access to the data? And again, if so, whom? Are those subcontractors? Does the client have the ability to approve the subcontractors? And I would like to include provisions requiring the vendor to flow down key confidentiality and security terms to their subs. From a client perspective, you certainly should be seeking an indemnity against breaches of the confidentiality and privacy terms. Of course, many vendors will push back on this. Some provide it readily, others do not. But many will fall in the middle of pushing back, but perhaps in the end agreeing to the indemnity with or without a cap. Moving on to the next slide, the intellectual property rights that a customer is concerned about in many managed services agreements relate mainly to the customer's own data and making sure that you maintain ownership of your data and any derivatives of the data. If you're working off of the vendor's terms, or the vendor has marked up your terms, one thing to look for is the vendor trying to have the right to use your data for other purposes. Many vendors are also trying to build data analytics businesses, for example, and you need to be mindful of how they want to use your data and whether that's acceptable or not. I have seen deals blow up over differences of views on whether reuse of the customer's data is acceptable or not. As for any software provided by the vendor, it's hard to say whether there's any set answers here. There's vendors who license software where the license extends beyond the term of the managed service. That's rare. More typically, any software or software license is solely during the term. And also, any customization to that software is typically owned by the vendor. But you can push for ownership over customizations if the goal is to avoid third parties, other customers having access to the changes. But the risk that's often associated with taking that position is that the customizations to the software don't form part of the product, and you may have higher maintenance costs because your customizations would then need to be brought into each new version of the software. The other hand, if you cede ownership of customizations to the vendor, I think the main thing you should be looking for is their commitment that those customizations will become part of the baseline and there's no then ongoing maintenance charge. If the managed service is one that is ticket-based, you definitely want ownership over your tickets or a license that to use your ticket data after the end of the agreement that is essentially unfettered. When I say a ticket, what I mean is that there are many services that are based upon the idea that you would request services through initiating a process that starts with either filling out a form or making a call, and a ticket being entered into a database such as ServiceNow that keeps track of the requests and issues. An example of it might be if the managed service is desktop support of end user workstations in a banking environment, for example, or in any environment, there will be a ticket database because users, when they request support, will call the help desk and say, my computer's broken, and a ticket will be opened in ServiceNow or another tool, and that ticket will keep track of what was requested, how long it took for it to be fixed, and various other pieces of information relevant to the services. That data is vital to understanding the service that you're receiving, and down the road, if you want to look at other vendors as you're approaching the end of the term and you want to have another RFP, you're going to want to be able to reuse that ticket data to be able to let other vendors see what your service environment is like so that they know how to bid it. Moving on to representations and warranties. First of all, I think it's helpful to take a step back and make sure we're clear about what's a warranty, what's a representation, and what's a covenant. Covenant is the simplest one. That's any contractual commitment. Customer will pay within 30 days, or vendor will perform the following services. Those are covenants. It's a straight-up contractual commitment. You either do it or you don't. If you don't, you're in breach. If you do it, great. A representation is a statement of material fact upon which a party is intended to rely. Some vendors are very particular on this issue and will not provide representations about future statements, for example, that the services will be performed in a particular manner, or that the software that they provide does not infringe intellectual property rights. And they will take that position on the grounds that those are statements about the future, and you can't represent the future unless you possess a crystal ball. Which leads to the third head of commitment, which is a warranty. I like to describe warranties as promises that are envisaged being broken and cured. When you buy a car and it has a 100,000-mile warranty, they're not promising it won't break. They're promising they will fix it. Likewise, from a vendor's perspective, the warranty that the services will be performed in a timely manner and in conformance to specifications is at some level a promise that that's true, but at another level a promise that if that doesn't occur, that it will be corrected. So forward-looking statements are often put in terms of either warranties or covenants, depending upon whether there's a tolerance for failing to perform in accordance with the statement. If there's no tolerance, it's a covenant. And if there is tolerance for the failure to perform, it's a warranty, because then if it's cured, the breach of warranty has been addressed. So there's a number of potential warranties that I've listed here. I spare you reading them all to you. One thing to consider is anti-bribery. Many companies have policies that require anti-bribery warranties, and I think that they are routine in agreements. In particular, you should consider the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the UK Bribery Act. It, like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, applies not just in the UK, but broadly to multinationals. Compliance with applicable customer policies is particularly important if there's on-site personnel, access to client systems, or access to client-facing data. And also conformance with the security plan. I think this is better as a covenant, because you really don't want there to be non-conformance with the security plan. You want them to conform. So I don't, from a customer's perspective, don't think this should be a warranty. I think this should be a covenant. Moving on to liability. First of all, the market practice in managed services agreements is that there will be a limitation of liability. I think pushing hard when you're on the client side for there to be no cap on liability is not necessarily time well spent, because I've seen extraordinarily few managed services agreements where there's no cap on liability unless the customer has dramatically greater market power than the vendor. And even then, I would be concerned from a customer's perspective about any vendor who's willing to agree to uncapped liability on every deal they do. That, in my mind, means that vendor can be wiped out by any other customer. And so one has to question whether that vendor will be around. So the limits of liability that I'm used to seeing is typically based upon the a period of time, such as 6 months fees. I've seen as little as 3 months. I think that's the low end of market. I have also seen 12 months in deals where it's a large deal and the vendor really wants it. I've also seen multiples, such as or longer periods, so 24 months fees or two times the last 12 months fees. Also, I have seen transactions where their limits of liability are flat sums or are based upon the vendor's insurance, but that's typically in situations where the vendor's key concern is keeping their liability capped by their insurance. So, if there's going to be a limit of liability, the key concern is, what are the carve-outs? I definitely, from a customer's perspective, want breach of confidentiality or privacy to be a carve-out. Some vendors will agree to that. Others have a very hard time with that, in which case I think a fallback position where the parties sometimes meet is a super cap that might be a much larger sum of money, such as maybe $5 million, or depending on the deal, $50 million, or a multiple of the normal cap, where the super cap for breach of confidentiality is a multiple of the normal cap. I don't think I've seen that multiple be less than 3. Gross negligence is a typical carve-out in some states. I think you need to be mindful of what is the definition of gross negligence under the particular state law that is governing the agreement. At one extreme, New York's definition of gross negligence is very high, and under New York state law, it's against public policy, common law. It's against public policy to endeavor to limit your liability for gross negligence. So I think a wise vendor will immediately agree and might even in their own form agree to carve out gross negligence from the cap on liability in New York State. The opposite end, both geographically and jurisdictionally, Florida has a very soft definition of gross negligence, which is more akin to regular negligence. And I would not advise a vendor to carve out gross negligence from the cap on liability if Florida's law will apply. What you can do in that situation, though, is perhaps define gross negligence along the lines of the New York law. If you need a good definition, email me and I can send you an example. Indemnities are typically carved out from the limits of liability, including the IP infringement indemnity. Data loss, data breach, is we discussed with breach of confidentiality. And the indemnities, the IP indemnity is typical. Personal injury / tangible property is also typical if vendor personnel will be on site. Violation of law is another one I look for from a customer's perspective, and breach of confidentiality and data privacy, if that's relevant. You definitely want to make sure that the vendor has insurance and have insurance requirements in the contract. Get your coverage team involved, whether you're on the customer side or the vendor side, to review the provisions and make sure that they're in alignment with your needs. You definitely want expert advice on that, not just from lawyers, but from insurance experts. Termination. Termination for cause, at least from a customer's perspective, should be one-sided except for non-payment. A failure to pay, there should be very limited or no reason why the vendor would want to terminate the customer. There are situations if there's a lot of intellectual property involved from the vendor that might be another carve out. But what I'd like to see when I'm on the client side is really reining this in, because there should be very few reasons why the vendor should be able to get out of the deal. I always worry about the vendor wanting to be able to get out if they think that might be to their economic advantage rather than it really being based upon a fundamental breach that makes them no longer want to do business. The ability to terminate for convenience should be entirely unilateral with the client. And one thing to consider on renewal is making sure that you have a long enough lead time when you're on the client side from the vendor that if they don't wish to renew or if they wish to raise the price, that you know that well enough in advance that you can issue an RFP and do a procurement. So therefore, the vendor being able to give you 60 days notice of non-renewal probably doesn't work. You're going to want a longer period than that. You need to think about what's the right period under the circumstances. Transition assistance is very important in managed services. You need to think about what are the set of services you're going to need in order to move to another solution at the end of the deal that's going to involve the transfer of your data, including the ticket data if applicable. But think about what activities are involved in getting onto this service and make sure that you are receiving a similar bundle of services and there's a contractual obligation to provide a similar bundle of services at the end of the deal. Force majeure If any element of the managed services are off-site from the client, and they typically are, you're going to want a business continuity plan from the vendor, and that should be part of the contract. Normally, you're going to want an annual test of that. And if this is a shared service, you may not have that, you may not be able to have that test be dedicated to you. But if that is the case, then there should be some sort of test report that you get that shows that the business continuity plan was executed or tested and what the results of that test were. And if there were any failures in that process, how those are going to be remediated. You also need to consider in your perspective of what needs to be in the BCP about how critical are the services. To take again the example of the insurance back office, the insurance company can't run if the back office functions aren't there. So the business continuity plan needs to be robust. It needs to involve a hot failover site, which means that there's already equipment there, which is fully configured, and where the data is constantly mirrored there, at least on an hourly basis. On the other hand, if the managed service is something that maybe is something you can do without completely if it's not there, a much less thorough BCP is needed. Dispute resolution is, at some level, what I would call a religious issue, or at least as regards to whether you want mediation or court. That is a topic that people argue about a great deal, and I'm going to defer that rather than trying to convert the believers on either side. What I do think is important is to have some informal dispute resolution procedures that escalate issues beyond the day-to-day personnel to higher ups on both sides and have a set timeline for that escalation so that more senior people who are not emotionally invested in the issues get involved, if that's possible. I absolutely think it's critical to have U.S. jurisdiction on dispute resolution or jurisdiction in another venue in which the customer has a business operation. Having to go to the vendor's home country to pursue claims is not going to be a practical solution. If the vendor's only willing to agree to jurisdiction outside of the place where the services are being performed, you should seriously consider finding another vendor. Because if you have to go, you're just going to Ontario, but if you're going to have to go to Germany or South Korea or India or wherever to address any issues, it's not a very meaningful right. Also, you should do your due diligence and make sure that the vendors has assets in the U.S. or in the applicable jurisdiction where disputes are to be resolved, so that if there is a problem and there is a judgment, there are assets there that are at risk. Remember your key boilerplate provisions. A lack of a severability clause is, in my view, malpractice, because in many states the common law says that if any provision is of the agreement is not enforceable, the entire contract is invalid. And the severability clause overrides that common law default principle. You want to limit, if you can, the vendor's right to assign the agreement. But also remember the difference between assignment and delegation. Assignment just means assigning the rights. Delegation is transfer of duties. And unless you've got a provision that clearly allows the delegation of an agreement, that can't typically happen without consent. Many vendors will push for a press release to be part to be signed as part of the deal package or agreed to as part of the deal package. You may be comfortable with that. You may not be comfortable with that. From a client's perspective, holding back on agreement to that as it may be an important part of reaching the final pricing terms. Sometimes that last mile on the discounts or other payment terms may be bridged by agreeing to the press release. So scope of services, the scope of services is in many ways the most important part of the contract. If you don't make the scope of services clear, then you don't really have an enforceable contract. So you need to get your arms around what it is that you're buying, why you're buying it, why you're paying for it, and how you're paying for it. When I say this is the most important part, a client recently approached me, sent me an extract of the contract with the limit of liability clauses, and said, and a short description of what the failure that the vendor had done, and said, what are our remedies? Well, my immediate response was, you've got to send me the scope of services because I need to see where it is that they promised to do the thing they didn't do. Because if they never promised to do it, then they're not in breach. So what the amount of the limit of liability isn't relevant if you're not in breach. So the scope of services needs to be clear so that, if nothing else, number one, the business people are in agreement on what they're doing. And number two, if down the road there's a problem, you can point to something and say, it said here, Mr. Vendor, you were going to do this. Service levels are a key part, and I'm on slide 18 at this point. Service levels are a key point, part of any managed services agreement. Because these are long-term deals, and because the ability of the client to get out of the deal is both constrained by the costs of moving to another vendor and often by limitations on termination rights or prepaid services fees, service levels are used to measure service quality, manage service quality, and in the worst case, be a remedy for some service failures. Typically, you need to make sure that the service levels drive the right behavior. To use a simple example, if the managed service involves the call center, that where people are going to be answering calls and trying to help the caller do something, resolve an issue, whatever it is, there's a number of ways of measuring that service. One is to measure the length of the average call. Another is to measure the percentage of calls where the caller's problem is resolved. Those two measures are diametrically opposed and drive opposite behaviors. Measuring the length of the call, at least if the call time, you're measuring that calls don't exceed a certain length, makes the agent want to get off the phone. The other hand, if you are measuring the percentage of calls resolved, that makes the agent want to stay on the phone to resolve the issue, because the agents are typically going to be measured on the service levels also. So you got to make sure as you build your service levels that they are driving the right behavior. They also service levels will drive price issues. To follow that same call center example, another metric is call answer time. That's the period of time between when a caller...
Esquire CLE's second verification code is CHANNEL, C-H-A-N-N-E-L, CHANNEL. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is CHANNEL, C-H-A-N-N-E-L, CHANNEL. Please take a moment and write this down.
Has hit the last menu option that will direct them to an agent. So that may just be when the phone rings for a simple situation, or it might be after the caller has gone through some menu process. So it's the period of time from when they go into the call queue to when the call is answered by an agent. The shorter the average call answer time, the more agents are needed. And so therefore, the higher the cost will be. So you also need to consider where not to use service levels. As we'll discuss in a minute, often service level credits are the sole remedy or the primary remedy for service level breach. You're not going to want a service level then for something where your primary concern, if it happens, is to be able to recover your damages. So to me, the classic example is about data breach. You don't want service levels around data breach. You want covenants on data breach, on data security, and the ability, if you're the client, to recover damages if the data is breached. So, typical service level examples are here on slide 19. Slide 20, service level credits. For a simple service with a small number of service levels, the typical service level credits are either going to be set dollar amounts or percentage of the monthly fees. For larger, more complex services, you can run into very complex structures that, I've had deals where there were 30 or 40 service levels, and then you start to have a pool of allocation points, and you're allocating the points to each service level, and you, in that situation, also get into a discussion of whether the number of allocation points should add up to 100, as in 100% of the service level credits that are available for a given month, or some larger percentage, so that basically it comes down to, if you use an allocation system, in order for the revenue at risk for that month to be forfeit by the vendor, does the vendor have to miss every service level? Or if they miss half the service levels, for example, should that be so bad that they have to pay all of the service level credits? If you have 200 allocation points and you're spreading them across the service levels, then you will get to a situation where missing half of the service levels could mean that all of the service level credits for the month are due. Again, if you need an example of this or you'd like to discuss what I mean, because this is a very complex area, feel free to send me an email. My contact information is at the end. And when I said, by the way, the revenue at risk, in large deals, there tends to be that the revenue, that the service level credits will be based upon a certain percentage of the monthly fee being the revenue at risk, typically somewhere between 5 and 10%. I've seen 15% or more. But if, for example, it's $100,000 a month and your revenue at risk is 10%, then that means $10,000 is the service level credit pool, if you will, for that month. And then if you have an allocation point system and a certain service level is missed and then there's 10 allocation points on that, that means 10% of the service level credit pool would be the service level credit for that service level, and that service level miss. So in that example, 10% of the $10,000 or $1,000. In large deals, you'll often see earn back provisions that allow for the vendor to earn back a service level credit that they've had to pay by making or meeting that service level for a certain number of months after the miss. The intent, so for example, if they make the service level for 3 months after the miss, they get back half the credit. And if they make it for 3 months more, the next 3 months more, so 6 months consecutive, they get the whole thing back. I think that's a good compromise position because it gives the vendor an incentive to be consistent, and it incents the right behavior, which is consistent performance and not a punishment for a random miss. On the other hand, earn forward provisions that let the vendor earn up a credit of goodwill that they can apply against service level credits. I've never agreed to that from a customer's perspective. Typically, also from a customer's perspective, I'm going to want something that says that if you miss a number of key service levels multiple times in a row or a certain number of times over a period, then I can terminate, and or if you have to pay the maximum credit in a certain number of times in a row or a certain number of times in a period, like 3 times in 6 months, then I should have the right to terminate. So on pricing issues, there normally is going to be a rate card or unit/service pricing. I think from a customer's perspective, unit/service pricing is normally preferred, where the price is based upon the output, not the inputs. You care more not about how much time the vendor spent to do things, but the predictability of each whatever it is, you know, each ticket, for example. In the desktop support instance, maybe it's each ticket that is put in is a certain price, or each computer that's supported is a certain price. And I think that that's the right metric, is the unit in that case is the end user supported. Not every deal it lends itself to that. On the insurance deals that were the example at the beginning, the right answer may just be a fixed monthly charge. What I think the key from a customer's perspective is you want the pricing to be based upon something that you understand and that you either control, or if you don't control it, at least it's rationally related to what you're getting. So again, number of users supported or number of a certain type of price per output or unit, or and not, again, how much time the vendor spent. That's the vendor's problem. From a customer's perspective, in long-term deals, you may want a benchmark clause that allows you to bring in a third party to look at the pricing, compare it to comparable vendors, and force a price cut if the pricing's over market. From a vendor's perspective, of course, that's not acceptable, but I've also seen as a compromise that at least the benchmarking process requires cooperation and discussion, but doesn't allow the benchmarker to drive a price change. Often rate increases are going to be, because these are long-term deals, you're going to need an escalator. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Obviously, from a customer's perspective, the first answer is no. But particularly if the service is heavily labor-based, you're typically going to see something based upon a price increase based upon inflation. From a customer's perspective, I like to see that be the lesser of inflation or some number like 3%. From a vendor's perspective, I think it's right to be concerned that perhaps inflation is going to be getting more aggressive. And so maybe those sort of the lesser of inflation or 3% might not play out well 5 years from now. Governance, I think, is critically important. You need to have regular meetings. You need to have regular reporting. If this managed service was being performed internally, presumably there would be regular internal management meetings, reports, measurements, any of the things that you would do to manage internal resources, to measure the management of this function, if it were in-house, should be part of your governance structure for managing the vendor. Getting a managed service doesn't mean that the management of that function is no longer an internal responsibility. It just means that everything from within the service is now the vendor's problem, but managing the vendor is still a customer responsibility. That doesn't go away. So process steps in managed services, typically there's the requirements gathering I discussed. You may want to run an RFI to get some free consulting on what options are out there and what vendors propose. That will help you build a good RFP, run an RFP. And I really recommend for any kind of large transaction, selecting down to two vendors and negotiating with both of them to a full contract. That sounds like more work than negotiating with one, but from a customer's perspective, I think it's a much less work because the vendors are still in a competitive mode. And having been on the vendor side too, I will tell you, their internal salespeople will be putting pressure on the lawyers on the vendor side to get the deal done and not to fight. And not to be, the sales guys will always be worried that they're going to lose because they were hard to deal with. So I think if your business people are saying we don't have time for all this process, you need to get two vendors involved and negotiate against both of them. That will be faster than negotiating against one that knows it has you over a barrel. So where can a lawyer do the most damage in these kinds of deals? I think, first of all, focusing on non-issues. If there's no personal data involved, digging in your heels and saying, I want all of these privacy terms and GDPR and I need a standard contractual terms attached is just wasting time. And if a vendor is not is providing a service that doesn't involve personal data, then they're not going to be set up to handle personal data. And so pounding on the table about that is just a time waster. On the other hand, if those provisions are important, then yeah, pound away. But just make sure you're focusing on something that's a real issue. The second place the lawyer can really hurt the client, particularly on the client side, is just reading the T's and C's. You need to read the scope of services, you need to read the service levels, and if you don't understand it, have people explain it to you. Because if you don't understand it, a judge is not going to understand it either. So, and remember that scope of services is the most important part, and the service levels are in many ways the greatest tool that your client is going to have in managing the vendor and getting some sort of remedy if the service isn't what it should be on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, my contact information is on the last slide, including my phone number and my email address. If you have any questions, please do feel free to email me. Obviously, if you email me, that doesn't make you my client, but I am happy to answer questions. And because I really enjoy this area, I've been doing it a long time, and always happy to share knowledge. Thank you very much.